own death. When we jump in, head straight for the Ruha cruiser at maximum speed, he ordered the executive officer. The man nodded soberly. Since the Glory could not survive the upcoming fight, she would truly seek glory by attempting to ram the Ruhar cruiser Rue Gestalo.
The clan will sing about the glory of our battle forever, the executive officer said loudly so the entire bridge crew could hear clearly.
Privately, he thought of the frigate's brothership, Every Day is a Good Day to Die in Battle. That ship had died in battle already. Was this day, a very ordinary day until minutes ago, a good day to die? As good as any, the exec thought, although he would have preferred some warning to mentally prepare himself.
Jump drive is ready, Captain, he announced. Engaging now.
Aboard his command ship, Rue Gestalo, Commodore Ferlant's mind was still reeling. What else could go wrong with this mission, he asked himself. It was supposed to be a simple and relatively easy assignment. The fleet had taken Gitanu away from the Kristang. With their losses elsewhere in the sector, the Theranin were in no position to support a Kristang effort to retain control of the star system. Unexpectedly, a handful of Kristang ships had stayed in the system and began raiding the planet. That was an annoyance, not a serious threat. Then the Kristang had inexplicably began shooting at the clients, the humans, and the chief administrator of Gitanu had informed Ferlant that his task force needed to protect the humans also. Ferlant's ships were already stretched thin protecting the northern continent of Tenturo. Extending coverage to the southern continent greatly strained his ship's ability to protect the Ruhar population and infrastructure on Tenturo. Then, just when Ferlant thought he had discouraged the raiders, the Kristang out of nowhere had arrived with an entire battle group. Ruhar fleet intelligence had assured Ferlant that there was no way the Kristang would or could reinforce their few ships near Gitanu. No way. There was no possibility that the Kristang would even be able to get weapons and spare parts to their ships. All Ferlant needed to do, fleet intelligence had told him, was to hang on until the Kristang ships fell apart. The impossible had happened, and Ferlant had barely escaped with his tiny force intact. Having an enemy battle group appear absolutely out of nowhere, to land practically in his lap, had been shocking enough. Moments before, he had received notice that projectors on Gitanu had destroyed much of the Kristang battle group. The message from the Ruhar government on the planet had screamed at him why Ferlant had violated the ceasefire, and why he had not informed the government about the defense capabilities of their own planet. After wasting a few precious seconds on paralyzing shock, Ferlant had replied that he knew nothing about any projectors on Gitanu, and why hadn't the government informed him? Then he ordered his task force to immediately begin dispersing according to Action Plan 3. Because some of his ships were undergoing running repairs, they could not initiate a jump until they switched to backup systems. Ferlant was holding his own cruiser back to cover the stragglers.
McMurrow reports ready for jump, Commodore,
a bridge officer behind Ferlant reported. Without turning away from the main tactical display, Ferlant acknowledged with a curt nod.
Wait until McMurrow's ship is confirmed successful. Then take us to the rendezvous.
Enemy ship jumped in. One frigate. It's that damned target Beta Glorious something, whatever its name is, the officer reported. That damned lucky ship that kept raiding us.
Ferlant's lip curled in a wry smile.
That little ship is annoyingly persistent, isn't she?
Commodore, if we turn to expose our starboard railgun battery, we could take that ship out with one shot, the officer suggested.
Yes.
Ferlant's eyes narrowed as he stared at the red symbol in the tactical display. That little enemy ship had been the bane of his existence. He could finally be rid of it with one shot.
You have permission to maneuver the ship.
By luck more than skill, the frigate's creaky jump drive somehow brought the ship into the Ruhar formation and miraculously less than 70,000 kilometers from the Rue Gestalo. Against the much larger and heavily shielded Ruhar cruiser, the Glory had no chance, even for a suicide run, for the cruiser's weapons would pound the little frigate into space dust long before the Glory approached. Glory aimed her own maser cannons and fired, with the beams easily deflected by the cruiser's more powerful shields. The Glory had to turn more than 90 degrees to engage the Rue Gestalo, and by the time the frigate made the turn and began accelerating with maximum force, the executive officer noticed something odd. Where were the other ships of Commodore Ferlant's small task force? There were only two ships within the frigate's sensor bubble, and as he watched, a destroyer jumped away, leaving only the cruiser. As the Glory was rocked by direct maser fire from Rue Gustalo, the executive officer's fingers flew over his own console. The other ships had jumped away only moments ago. He could still detect strong residual jump signatures. The ship was rocked again.
"Captain," he shouted a warning. "Shields collapsing."
One more maser volley from Rue Gustalo and the Glory would be defenseless. She was still over 60,000 kilometers from the target. By the time the cruiser blew up the frigate's reactor, Glory would be too far away for the cruiser to be damaged by the explosion. The crew of the Glory would die without having struck a significant blow against their long-hated enemy. If today was indeed a good day to die, it was not a good day to find Glory in battle. The frigate would find only frustration and death, not Glory. Why was the cruiser not firing her railguns? At such short range, a single railgun round could easily penetrate the Glory's hull, bow to stern, and, in a burst of gamma radiation, the cruiser vanished.
"What happened?" the exec asked himself. "Captain, the enemy ship has jumped away. They all jumped away. We can..."
He looked to the sensor officer for confirmation.
"We might be able to follow one of the ships. Their jump signatures are very recent and strong."
Catching the sensor officer's worried look, the exec added,
"Considering the condition of our sensors, we would be using guesses more than science to track an enemy ship, Captain."
"No," the captain replied, suppressing a shudder of relief at having avoided death once again.
"Our orders were to attack the enemy task force. It is now dispersed, and we are unable to follow. Send a signal to the Green Rendezvous Point,
the hopefully secret location where the battle group was to assemble.
Inform them that the enemy task force has dispersed and request orders. The enemy received the news before we did," the captain declared with a mixture of regret and gratitude.
"Or," the executive officer said darkly,
"they knew the exact timing of their projector attack and fled away for safety. The Ruhar are both treacherous and cowardly, Captain."
The captain nodded silently, agreeing with the obvious wisdom of his executive officer's statement. To himself, the captain said a prayer. With the ceasefire now over, Kristang's ships might again be called upon to raid Pardassus. This time, powerful maser cannons would be the primary threat to raiding ships. What could the battered little frigate do against a projector? Nothing, except to serve as target practice.
"They are treacherous and cowardly," the captain observed. "And apparently they are very, very clever."
At the Rue Gustalo's assigned Action Plan 3 primary jump point, the cruiser emerged in a gamma ray burst. She ejected quantum resonators to cover the tracks of her next jump, and as soon as the ship's jump drive was realigned, she jumped again to the secondary point. There would be three more jumps before she rejoined the task force, a precaution because Action Plan 3 assumed the enemy would be pursuing, chasing Ferlant's task force around the star system. The cruiser jumped again and proceeded away in a random direction at full thrust, waiting for her jump drive to recharge.
"Jump successful, Commodore. No sign of pursuit."
"Commodore, may I ask why we did not fire railguns at that enemy frigate?"
Ferlant turned away from the tactical display. This was an opportunity to provide coaching to the young officers of his staff.
"That frigate has somehow survived against the odds, at times when it seemed certain her fate was sealed. Fate has determined this is not yet her time. I have learned that one should never argue with fate."
"Yeah!" Admiral Cacrondo shouted in a frustration that felt like physical pain, and he quickly spun to find something, anything, that he could smash. His officers knew from long experience never to be close at hand when the Admiral was enraged, which happened frequently. The never-ending hero of the Admiral's staff was their lowest-ranking member, who had the task of sprinkling around the bridge things that broke in a satisfying but non-lethal manner. Electronic tablet? Yes. Pistol with fully charged energy pack that might explode if broken in just the right manner? No. Pistol with depleted energy pack that would give very satisfying sparks and, at worst, a few second-degree burns to an unlucky person on the bridge? Very much yes. It was a great system, a system that had worked many, many times over. The system had never been tested under such intensely stressful conditions. Gikrondo had been preparing for a war game, which was why he was aboard the destroyer we are proud to follow the shining example of combat rifleman Tut Wasval Kedwala instead of his command ship, the He Who Pushes Aside Fear Shall Always Be Victorious, which was why he was currently alive rather than a random assortment of rapidly cooling subatomic particles. Gikrondo had wished to observe the performance of the Victorious, and the best way to do that was to get off that ship so its captain and crew did not have an admiral looking over their shoulders. Fortunately, he had already been able to observe the Victorious in high-tensity combat. Unfortunately, that combat action had told him nothing illustrative about the performance of that ship's crew, because the battle had been a sneak attack by a ground-based projector against an unshielded ship, and because the Victorious was no longer an organized collection of components that resembled a starship. Gikrondo repeated, shocked, enraged, and humiliated at the incomprehensible defeat he had suffered. What were projectors doing on Perdassus, of all places? Seeing a pistol in its assigned slot on a bulkhead, he pulled the lever to release it and threw the weapon to the deck. It broke in several pieces, and its power pack came apart, spewing sparks around the bridge. One spark hit the sleeve of the officer sitting at the destroyer's sensor station, where that officer was running an analysis of the projector attack over and over again, trying to comprehend what had happened. Instead of flinching as the hot metal burned through his sleeve and into the skin of his forearm, the officer merely brushed it away as an annoyance. He burned his fingers and distractedly put the throbbing fingers in his mouth. His attention never wavered from the display. Something about that further enraged the admiral, plus the pistol breaking apart had not been as satisfying as it had been in the past. He reached over to one of his security staff, yanked the man's pistol from its holster, and fired at the sensor console. The console exploded, sending metal and composites flying around the bridge, some pieces even striking the admiral. Because consoles were designed not to injure their operators, the sensor officer was not badly injured. He was knocked off his chair and came shakily back to his feet with stars in his eyes to see an angry admiral pointing a smoking pistol at his face. The officer did not flinch. If Gikrondo wanted to kill him for any reason, there was nothing the officer could do about it. He and his family ranked too low in the clan hierarchy to even protest.
"Please, Admiral, if it serves the clan for me to die, then do it quickly so the ship can pursue the enemy."
Gikrondo snorted. First with surprise, then with laughter.
"Ha! Give me another 100 such men, and I will conquer the galaxy!"
He flipped the pistol back to his guard, looked at the stricken sensor officer, and demanded,
"Well, what are you able to tell me?"
The sensor officer strode over to a secondary console and activated it with no mention of the nearly fatal incident.
"We were attacked by 4 projectors, Admiral."
"Only 4?
Gikrondo was surprised. During the vicious sneak attack, it had seemed like the entire planet below had sprouted projectors, spitting deadly maser fire up at his ships.
"Only 4, the man confirmed. "They are oddly clustered together. The enemy's coverage of the sky is poor, with only those 4.
4 active, you mean?" Gikrondo asked. "How many others?"
"No, Admiral, there are only those 4. The sensor data did not detect targeting signals from any other sources. 2 of the 4 projectors here and here," he indicated, "are nearly depleted. We can tell from the reduced power of their last shots."
"It cannot be possible that the enemy has only 4 projectors on the entire planet," the admiral stated.
The officer did not back down.
"According to Clan Intelligence, Admiral, it cannot be possible that the enemy has even 1 projector on Perdassus."
Gikrondo looked at the man sharply to see if the admiral was being mocked. No, the man had correctly directed his scorn at the clan's intelligence group.
"Ha!" the admiral snorted. "Only 2 projectors to worry about, eh? We will see about that."
"Admiral," the destroyer's captain took the opportunity to step in. "Will we be pursuing the enemy ships?"
"Some of us will, Captain," Gikrondo replied. "And some of our ships will be testing how many projectors the enemy truly has."
Chapter 19.
"Can someone please explain to me what just happened?"
Deputy Administrator Baterna Logelia asked her staff in exasperation. She knew she was being unfair to her dedicated people. The chief administrator's office had shouted at her moments ago, so she was shouting at her staffers. They would shout at their own teams in turn, all the way down. And no one knew anything useful.
You.
She pointed at her military liaison, who was engaged in an animated conversation through an earpiece in his right ear, and had a second phone held up to his left ear.
Why, and how, did we fire on those Kristang ships?
The ceasefire had been thoroughly and very effectively broken. After jumping away, Admiral Kikrondo of the Kristang had warned of severe consequences from the remaining ships in his still-dangerous task force. The man lowered the phone from his left ear.
Pardon me, Administrator Logelia. We did not fire on the Kristang. I know that we didn't,
she tried to control her anger. The military had taken rash action that put at risk the civilian population, people she was responsible for.
Commodore Ferlant, it was not Commodore Ferlant,
the liaison officer stated firmly.
I received a message from his executive officer a moment ago. They were as surprised as we were. The Commodore has no idea who fired. In fact, he accused us of doing something that he considers to be incredibly stupid.
Well, Baterna threw up her hands in exasperation.
The planet didn't shoot at the Kristang by itself.
No, clearly, he agreed.
They were projectors, powerful maser cannons. I know what a projector is, Sleen.
She used the man's surname.
Whose projectors, if not ours?
She knew one thing for damn sure. The Ruhar government had never installed projectors on Gitanu. There was no way such a monumental effort could have been concealed.
It had to be the Kristang, ma'am. Before we first came to Gitanu. Somehow,
it was his turn to throw up his hands.
Someone activated them. Four projectors at least, by our last count.
But Turner's head was spinning.
You think they have been buried here, practically beneath our feet, all this time? That is the only explanation we can think of currently,
Sleen responded somewhat distractedly. He was listening to another, or several other, conversations in his earpiece.
Now that we know what these projectors look like, we should surely be able to scan for them, can't we? We must understand what we are dealing with, and who caused those projectors to fire without our authority. Yes, ma'am, we can scan, but the projectors are likely concealed by a stealth field and other countermeasures. That is why we never detected them before. We weren't looking before,
Baterna said hopefully.
We must immediately begin to scan the subsurface for— Excuse me, ma'am, but we will not be able to spare any aircraft for scanning projectors or even to investigate and secure the four we know of. Administrator, please come with me. We need to get you to safety.
Why? She did not budge from behind her desk.
The Kristang have gone.
She pointed to the ceiling.
Their ships are gone for the moment, yes. Administrator, we are faced with an almost unique military situation. With neither side having ships in orbit, combat aircraft become the most powerful means of securing control of this planet. I was just informed that the Kristang have launched waves of aircraft targeting our own airfields. The situation is very dangerous. We must be responding with our own aircraft.
Yes, ma'am. Sleen said, gesturing for the administrator's personal security team to hustle her away to an air raid shelter.
No one has fought for a pure air battle like this in several generations. Unfortunately, ma'am, we are about to see firsthand whether all of our theories of air combat strategy are worth the training time we invested. I suggest you be someplace safe when theory meets reality.
Baterna nodded, accepting the pleading look from her personal security team.
Very well. In my experience, Mr. Sleen, whenever theory meets reality, theory loses.
Yes, ma'am, the military liaison officer agreed, and turned his attention to coordinating crisis response teams. For this was certainly a crisis. For the initial wave of air attacks by the Kristang, they quickly launched dropships to fly high cover and provide the massed aircraft below with long-range sensor and targeting data. With laser links between the attacking aircraft and the three dropships, the attackers could stand off at a safe distance and launch missiles at well-defended targets. Once the Ruhar defenses were degraded, the aircraft could fly in to attack their primary targets. The three dropships were perfectly positioned for their role in the attack. They had climbed high, so their sensors swept the area between the Kristang aircraft and the Ruhar airbase, and with their active sensors able to detect a rough location for even stealth Ruhar aircraft, The Kristang aircraft were able to hug the terrain at low altitude and remain in stealth. Because dropships could climb above an atmosphere, they could not be effectively engaged by aircraft, so the Ruhar had to send their own very limited number of dropships to counter the Kristang. At the start of this massive air battle, the Ruhar were at a serious disadvantage in combat power. Until the Kristang battle group arrived, the Ruhar had assumed their defensive needs could be handled by Commodore Ferlant's small task force. The Ruhar federal government had not wanted to ship combat aircraft and dropships all the way to a remote planet they intended to leave. Most of the combat air power the Ruhar had at the start of the air battle was left over from when humans had used them during the evacuation. Due to need for regular maintenance on the worn-out aircraft and lack of spare parts, 30% of the Ruhar's combat aircraft were unavailable when the Kristang launched their attack. Thanks to Skippy, we had a complete view of the developing air battle that would become known among humans as the Great Paradise Furball. With hundreds of aircraft tangling in intense dogfights, it was like a ball of fur rolling around and around in the sky. The Ruhar and Kristang had similar names for the battle, and no one involved ever forgot a single detail. The first shot in the Great Paradise Furball wasn't fired by the Kristang or the Ruhar. It was fired by a shiny beer can. Those three dropships looked like trouble to me. While I wasn't a fighter pilot, my infantry experience had taught me the value of high ground, and those dropships had the high ground. Skippy, can you do something about those three dropships?
Yeah, I got it, Joe. No problemo.
No problem. You told us that each projector can only cover 28% of the sky from its position, I reminded our smart-ass AI.
28% on a projector's normal settings, Joe. I am going to cheat.
Of course you are, I rolled my eyes. Please, O greatest of great ones, allow us mere mortals a glimpse into your awesomely wondrous plan.
Oh, I like that. Damn, Joe, that almost sounded sincere.
From now on, I'm going to make you monkeys address me that way when you want something, like me programming the jump drive.
That sounds like an excellent deal, Skippy, and from now on I'm going to move you from your personal escape pod man cave to a little basket on the side of the toilet next to the galley.
On second thought, Joe, you can just keep calling me Skippy the Magnificent. How about Asshole Almighty?
I'm sure we can reach a compromise somewhere in there, Joe.
I'm sure we can.
Is this where you're going to warp space-time to bend the maser beam or something like that?
No, Joe, I am not going to bend a beam of light, you moron. I can only do that over longer ranges, and I can't wrap space-time so close to an inhabited planet. That's too dangerous.
Do you want to hear what I'm going to do?
No. You talk too freaking long, Skippy. I pointed to the display with symbols for the dropships, which were now at about their maximum altitude. They were about to launch missiles at a Ruhar airbase.
We don't have time for talk. You need to show me.
Skippy did show me, and I would give that show a 5 out of 5 in terms of entertainment. The Kristang dropship pilots didn't leave a review after the action because they were, you know, dead. I'm thinking their review would not have been 5 stars. The 3 dropships very reasonably thought they were safe from attack by projectors. The dropships were at high altitude, higher than an aircraft could fly, but not so high that they were above the atmosphere. The dropships were to the south of the direct path from the Kristang airbase to their Ruhar targets. Going to the south brought them out of the targeting cones of the 4 projectors they knew about. The dropship pilots were aware that they were being used as bait to determine whether we had projectors we hadn't used yet. Still, they surely must have thought they were safe from being struck by the 4 projectors they knew about. They should have been safe. They did not know about Skippy.
Hey, Skippy, I pointed at the display. Those dropships are in stealth. How can you determine their position closely enough to target them?
Simple, Joey. I asked them to tell me.
Huh?
Following standard Kristang practice, those dropships are sharing data with a tight beam laser link. That allows them to, for one thing, avoid crashing into each other while they are in stealth. The problem for them is that while the laser beam is narrow, it does bounce off air molecules, and because I am the all-seeing Skippy the Magnificent, I can tell exactly where those ships are. Now, shut up for a minute and let me do my thing. Skippy, being the genius that he is, he was able to make the projectors do things they had not been designed to do. When the projectors had been installed, they were lowered into the ground in one piece, and then motorized magnetic pistons were attached to aim the beam.
Skippy made some of those pistons retract to their original position way down in the hole where they had been before explosive charges blew away the dirt over the buried projectors, and the business end of the projector's muzzle was extended above the surface. With the set of pistons off balance, the beam projector was knocked to one side. Knocked to the side toward the three Kristang dropships. That still wasn't enough of an angle to bring those dropships directly into the targeting cone, so Skippy used another trick. He defocused the beam. Normally, you want a microwave laser beam to be as narrow as possible so it can put all of its power on one target, so it can slice an armored starship in half, for example. Skippy fired the projector on low power in a series of broad pulses, more like a flashlight than a thin beam. The maser pulses scorched a broad area of the air as they traveled through the atmosphere. Scorched the air enough that the dropships, which were at high altitude but still within the atmosphere, were suddenly subjected to extreme overheating as the air around them was converted into plasma. The air around them briefly became like the photosphere of a star, and backscatter from the defocused maser pulses reflecting off air molecules struck the dropships directly. In less than a second, the extreme heat caused the dropship power cells, missiles, and warheads to explode.
"Did that do the job, Joe?" Skippy asked.
"Let's see. There were three dropships up there, and now I count... not three. No, not two either, or one. I count zero dropships. Zero is less than three, right, Joey?" "Let me kick my boots off so I can count on my toes, Skippy. I am a dumb monkey, remember?"
"Okay. I think we're good. Unless you consider disorganized pieces falling toward the ground as a dropship."
"No. You did it. Thank you, Skippy."
"You're not thanking me on behalf of those dropship pilots, are you, Joe? Because if you're hoping to get a fruit basket from them, you will be waiting a while."
"Wow," I whispered. "That's a whole lot of aircraft." On the dropship's display was a total view of the developing air battle, or I should say battles. There were seven distinct clusters of aircraft approaching each other at high speed, and as I watched, the fighters on both sides began turning to maneuver to gain an advantage. Thanks to the magic of Skippy the Magnificent, I had perfect situational awareness of every aspect of the battles, even though almost all of the aircraft was still in stealth mode.
"Yep," Skippy agreed. "This is going to be quite some show. There hasn't been an aircraft campaign like this in a very long time. Although perhaps campaign isn't the correct word, since I expect this whole thing to be over in a couple hours, max. Joe, do you want to grab some popcorn and watch the show in real time?"
"No, Skippy, I do not want any popcorn." I was angry at his insensitivity.
"It is not a show. This is real air combat. People are going to die. You may be immortal. The rest of us are not."
"Joe, I am terribly sorry," Skippy said, and this time he sounded sincere.
"You are right. I should not have said that. It was insensitive. You are a pilot now and a soldier. I should have considered that."
"Apology accepted, Skippy," which were words that I never thought I would ever be able to say.
Skippy apologizing?
"Is there anything we can do?" Already I could see aircraft on both sides firing masers at long range. They weren't likely to hit anything. The point was to keep the enemy at long range. Keep the enemy from closing on you until you wanted them closer on your terms. With the aircraft of both the Ruha and Kristang using stealth fields to confuse enemy sensors, defensive shields to deflect maser beams, and maser turrets to destroy incoming missiles, aircraft couldn't rely on fire-and-forget missiles like the U.S. Air Force did on Earth. Air combat in the war between the Ruha and Kristang was a close-range affair like World War II. Get close to the enemy aircraft, hammer it with maser pulses to degrade its shields, then finish it with a volley of missiles. Thinking about it, I shuddered. What I knew about flying was strictly peacetime maneuvers. I would hate to be in the skies above paradise right then.
"Anything we can do?"
"You mean, is there anything I can do?"
"Sure, Joe, there is a lot I can do. It would surprise me if we got permission to do much of it."
"You?
Since when do you ask permission to do anything?"
"Well, by we, I meant you, Joe. And by permission, I meant an okay from Count Chocula."
Oh, shit. I'd almost forgotten that nagging little detail.
Most of the things I could do that would be effective in giving the Ruha an advantage over the Kristang would risk being too obvious. The Kristang would figure out that some higher technology had been messing with the aircraft.
Exactly. What's worse is that the Ruhar would review the after-action sensor data and realize someone else was messing with the Kristang. The Ruhar would logically conclude that the Jarraptha must have been involved on their side, but when they inevitably ask the Jarraptha about it, the Jarraptha will certainly know they didn't help in the air battle, and that will start the Jarraptha asking uncomfortable questions and looking into things that are better left alone. I can see that would be a problem. That reminds me of something that has been troubling me for some time, Joe. The Theranin are not stupid. Their intelligence people surely by now have heard a rumor about a human escaping from a Kristang jail, and that same human stealing a Ruhar Dodo. The Dodo was taken aboard a Kristang frigate, and both that frigate and its star carrier mothership disappeared without a trace. I am surprised that the Theranin have not been investigating the accident. Or maybe they are, and we don't know it yet.
Shit, Skippy, that's not good.
It is most certainly not good at all, Joe. Which is why we must avoid any significant risk of me interfering in the battle to help the Ruhar in any way that looks suspicious. Count Chocula is annoyingly correct about that. We can't risk exposing our presence.
Crap. Turn the display off, Skippy. I don't want to watch this slaughter.
Wait. Joe, I said that I can't do anything obvious. I didn't say that I couldn't do anything at all. Come on, Joe, it's Skippy the Magnificent you're talking to here. Trust the awesomeness.
Trust the awesomeness. Will that be a new slogan? In spite of the situation, I had to laugh. On the display, aircraft were tangling in the most gigantic air battle I had ever imagined. The Ruhar were outnumbered.
What type of awesomeness do you have in mind, Skippy?
It was probably too late to request permission from Chotek. This was definitely an act now and ask forgiveness later kind of situation.
You know how the Kristang are bad at taking proper care of maintenance on their equipment because they consider that to be an inglorious task unfitting for warriors? Well, there are times when such lack of attention to detail can bite you in the ass. This is one of those times.
Skippy, are you doing something now without getting permission?
I have no idea what you're talking about, Joe.
Of course not. I rolled my eyes.
Let me ask it this way. If you were doing something, what might that be?
Oh, well, speaking hypothetically, it is possible that the Kristang aircraft are experiencing intermittent glitches in their networked fire control systems. These glitches are degrading their already crappy sensor capabilities. And, in an ironic coincidence, at the same time the Kristang are having glitches in their systems, the Ruhar aircraft have received an awesome software upgrade that they don't know about. This upgrade enhances the effectiveness of their stealth capabilities. The combined effect of these two totally unrelated coincidences is that the Ruhar have a significant advantage in air combat. Their aircraft can engage at longer ranges, while the Kristang have to fly relatively close to get a weapons lock on the Ruhar.
Cool, hypothetically.
Not as cool as I would like it to be, Joe. Ordinarily, this would mean the Ruhar are able to engage and disengage from combat at will. With that many aircraft tangling across the sky, they are so mixed up that the initial advantage of the Ruhar has been diminished. At this point, both sides are about even.
The Ruhar went into the fight at a disadvantage, Skippy. Making it an even fight is a great help.
Thank you.
Hypothetically, you are welcome. Oh, hey, if I forget, please remind me to wipe that software upgrade from the Ruhar's systems after the battle is over.
Joe, this is going to be a terrible slaughter on both sides. The Ruhar have already lost 7% of their airworthy combat aircraft, plus another 12% that were destroyed on the ground. The Kristang have lost 11% total so far. Both sides are quickly discovering that their tactics for air combat do not apply for a battle of this size and scope. The pilots are having to make this up on the fly. No joke intended. Joe, this air battle is going to be studied for hundreds of years.
I understand.
After that, we watched the action unfurl across the display. Skippy had the good sense to keep quiet, except for quietly bringing particularly significant events to my attention. Mostly, I sat silently as symbols on the display flared and blinked out. When the Kristang had launched waves of aircraft to attack Ruhar air bases, Saley and Derek had been headed back toward their own base. Then Saley received an order to change course and fly low and slow for maximum stealth. Ruhar Air Command had judged that Saley was too far away to help prevent the initial attack on her own airbase, so she was being held in reserve to strike the Kristang aircraft on the way back to their own bases to rearm and refuel. Saley had shaken with anger at doing nothing, while enemy missiles blasted the airbase where her friends worked and lived. Though the Ruhar military data link was being partly jammed by the Kristang, and the enemy had already knocked out many of the transmitters, the tactical communications system was designed to operate under wartime conditions. Derek still had a full picture of the situation across the surface of Gitanu. He kept Saley informed of what she needed to know, and didn't mention details that would only upset and distract her. From her seat in the front of the tandem cockpit, she could call up any tactical data she wanted. She didn't have all that much to do while the Dobra flew in lazy circles to achieve maximum stealth. Flying low to the ground meant that the fighter's already tiny signature would be mostly lost in ground clutter to any active sensors above. Flying slowly meant the Dobra was not leaving a long trail of disturbed air behind it. And they were flying slowly enough that Saley had only one of the two engines active. The active engine was using only its electrically powered fan blades, and therefore not radiating much heat at all. Secure inside their stealth field, Saley and Derek waited for a signal from Air Command.
"Derek, Lieutenant Bonsu," she addressed him by his human military rank. "We will be going into combat against the Kristang. We will be shooting directly at, killing, Kristang. This will be crossing a line. A human involved in hostile action against your patron species. I need to know if you have a problem with this. I need to know whether I can rely on you as my weapon systems officer."
"Yes," Derek responded immediately. "Absolutely, 100%. I know what the Kristang did to my home planet." Derek was among a growing percentage of humans on Paradise who feared the wormhole to Earth had been shut down deliberately by the Kristang to cover up what they were doing on that distant planet. Despite assurances from the Ruhar that the Kristang, nor the Theranin, nor even the Maxulks had the technology to control a wormhole, Derek thought it very suspicious that the only wormhole to humanity's home had shut down shortly after the Kristang lost control of Paradise. That could not be a coincidence. And if Derek could not do anything to directly help Earth, he could at least kill as many lizards as he could find in his weapons range. During the brief time when the Kristang battle group had total control around Paradise, Derek had feared he could never do anything to avenge the loss of his home world. Now, a miracle had cleared the skies of Kristang, and Derek Bonsu was not going to miss this golden opportunity. "Saley, you can absolutely count on me. Let's do this." Following orders from Ruhar Air Command, Saley had kept the Dobra flying slow, lazy circles as the four Kristang aircraft flew by. As soon as the enemy passed overhead, Saley went to full power on the engines to close the distance. Saley still had the ship in stealth and was about to drop the stealth field for combat maneuvering when Derek had shouted over the intercom, "Break right and cut power!" Saley pulled the aircraft into a gentle turn and throttled back the engines. Before she could ask, Derek explained, "They can't see through our stealth field. I've been watching them ping us with targeting sensors and they can't get a lock. I have a perfect lock on that lead ship with the Mesa guidance system." Saley checked her instruments. Derek was right. The enemy's active sensors were still pinging blindly. They couldn't get a lock on the Dobra's position. In air combat, both sides enveloped their aircraft in stealth fields until they began maneuvering into attack position and firing. At that point, with the range between aircraft closing, the high speed leaving turbulent air behind, and the engines radiating heat, stealth gave no advantage. Except that now, somehow the Kristang were not able to lock onto the Dobra, and her aircraft was maintaining a perfect lock as if the Kristang did not have stealth capability at all. Saley did not wait to wonder at the unexpected circumstances. That was for the experts to puzzle over later when they viewed the flight recorder data.
"Missiles, full spread."
Derek toggled three missiles at the aircraft he had been intending to fire at with the Maser cannon and another three at the aircraft's wingman. The six missiles dropped out of the back of the Dobra, ignited, and flew violently twisting evasive paths to their targets. With missiles in the air, Derek activated the Maser to target the same two aircraft. He was not trying to kill with the Maser. He only wanted the Maser to confuse the enemy's sensors and prevent the enemy defense Masers from hitting his missiles. He was only partly successful. The first aircraft's defenses exploded two missiles more than 10 kilometers away. Easy kills. But then its sensors seemed to go blind. The enemy fighter turned desperately as Derek watched his missile jinking side to side and up and down as it closed the distance. The enemy defensive Maser turrets were not firing at all.
They could not find a target to shoot at. Then the missile impacted the enemy directly, blowing it into pieces. The second aircraft shot down one incoming missile, and the other two were intermittently struck by defensive masers, but they were only glancing shots as the missiles quickly darted away. Both missiles flew by their evasive target, and their electronic brains concluded they did not have enough fuel to turn and re-engage the enemy. The brains also concluded they were close enough, so they both detonated their shaped charge fragmentation warheads toward the enemy. Pieces of warheads flew through the air on both sides of the enemy fighter, ripping into it and turning it into a fireball. Saley was stunned by the turn of events. In simulations, aircraft almost always were able to destroy incoming missiles with their defensive masers when missiles were launched at long range. It was only in the close quarters of a dogfight that missiles could home in before the enemy's defenses could knock them out. Yet here, now, she had fired missiles at two targets and destroyed both targets. The enemy still had not fired a shot at her, as they did not appear to be able to determine exactly where her Dobra was. Adapting quickly to the new reality, Saley maneuvered to maintain their distance to the two other enemy fighters. The enemy ruined her plan. They did not know why the Ruhar stealth field was so much more effective than they had expected, or what was wrong with their own targeting sensors. But they did know that if they let the Ruhar loiter at long range and fire missiles, they were both dead. So they pulled tight turns and went to full power, not caring whether they were that much more visible to the apparently superior Ruhar sensors. The range between the three combatants closed rapidly, and Saley was forced yet again to adapt. Derek Bonsu grunted from the strain in the back seat of the Dobra gunship as Saley pulled the fighter aircraft into another tight turn. The G-meter in front of him registered 8, and since gravity on the Ruhar homeworld was slightly higher than on Earth, it felt even heavier to Derek. Even in the advanced Ruhar flight suit he wore, his vision narrowed until all he could see was a small circle directly in front of his eyes. The Ruhar pilot was taking it easy on him, he knew. Genetically enhanced Ruhar pilots could sustain 12 Gs in combat turns. Having Derek as her Wizzo was actually a liability in air combat. Saley was endangering her own life and their mission in order to avoid killing her human co-pilot. The turn completed, the Dobra snapped back to a straight course, and Derek was thrown forward against the restraints as Saley cut power and the fighter decelerated rapidly.
"Stealth field is nominal," Derek managed to grunt. His whole world was reduced to the display and controls directly in front of him. He still had no peripheral vision.
The two enemy fighters were now again in front of them.
"We have target lock on the left-hand ship," he gasped between sucking in oxygen.
"Missiles?"
"Do it," Saley ordered. They were now too close to the Kristang for stealth to be of much use, and the Dobra had 12 missiles left. As Derek toggled off 6 missiles, she felt the Dobra lurch slightly as the aircraft suddenly weighed less. On her own controls, she pressed the button to activate the Dobra's maser cannon. At the same time, her own ship rocked as an enemy maser hammered her shields.
"Missiles inbound," Derek shouted. 10, 12, 14. "We can't track all of them," he warned.
The enemy had dumped almost all of their missiles blindly into the air, and now that the Dobra was firing a maser at full power and its engines were glowing hot, the enemy missiles had a target to chase.
"Saley, this is going to be close."
The display for their defensive computer was flashing red warnings that it had lost track of some enemy missiles, and the defensive maser turrets could only engage 2 missiles at once. A Ruhar Dobra gunship had 2 escape systems for the crew. Because the Dobra was a high-performance jet fighter aircraft designed to operate at supersonic speed and extreme altitude, the crew simply opening the canopy and ejecting was not an option. Instead, the entire 2-person tandem cockpit could separate from the disintegrating airframe. Moments after their own missiles turned the 4th and last Kristang fighter into a ball of fire, an enemy missile had exploded close behind them. Shrapnel took out both engines, shattering fan blades and causing a power cell to rupture. Knowing her aircraft was doomed, Saley reached down on the right side of her seat and flipped a switch to retract a safety cover, then pressed the recessed button, saying a silent prayer that the cockpit separation mechanism was still operable. As her fingers fumbled with the switch, the flight control computer realized that the aircraft was no longer a viable flying device and handed off control to the cockpit separation computer. That computer had been waiting for the flight control computer to make the blindingly obvious decision while the airframe broke apart around it, so it immediately engaged the separation process even before it received input from the pilot. Saley tried to shout a warning to Derek in the seat behind her, but with holes in the canopy, the shrieking wind was too loud even to be heard in the helmet speakers. Derek must know what was happening. She only had a moment to think, and he should be preparing to use the secondary separation button if the separation control computer failed to or was unable. With a roar, she heard over the wind. Explosive bolts released the cockpit from its connection to the airframe, and a small rocket motor pushed the cockpit section upward. Because the Dobra was falling apart and tumbling out of control, the cockpit computer's pre-programmed maneuver to straighten out the cockpit's own tumble and make it fly directly upward was the wrong move. As the bottom of the cockpit cleared the top of the airframe well it had rested in, the left side of the cockpit was struck by debris from the exploding left engine. A fan blade penetrated the cockpit's armor and struck just behind Saley. When the cockpit was not more than 2 meters above its well, the suddenly unbalanced airframe flipped in an eye blink, and the tail of the aircraft smashed into the rear of the rising cockpit. Derek's helmet was secured to the seat to prevent the pilot's neck from snapping. That didn't stop his brain from being bounced around inside his skull from the violent battering of the separation. Less than 5 seconds had passed since he shouted the warning about missiles approaching. The cockpit separation had not surprised him, but he hadn't heard a warning from Saley. When the rocket motor kicked the cockpit upward, his right arm had been reaching down for the separation button, while his left arm was still on the control stick trying to maintain some semblance of control over the failing aircraft. Separation had caught him unawares, and his left arm ached as if it had torn loose at the shoulder. Then something, two somethings, struck the cockpit, and the whole cockpit section was suddenly tumbling through the air on its own.
"Saley!"
he shouted, doubting the pilot could hear him. Through the canopy, blue sky and green forest flashed by like a strobe light, so quickly was the cockpit spinning. Too low. They had been flying at around 900 kilometers per hour when the enemy missile exploded, but at less than 1,000 meters altitude. The cockpit should have stabilized, then released a steerable triangular parachute to set them down softly. Instead, all the displays were dark, and the cockpit was tumbling worse than the aircraft had been.
"Saley, we need to get out of here! Saley!"
There was no response from in front of him. Possibly the pilot was unconscious, although the genetically enhanced body of a Ruhar should have withstood the strain better than his own fragile human biology. Derek could have reached for the handle between his legs to eject his own seat. He was not leaving without the pilot. Without waiting any longer, Derek reached for the black and yellow striped handle in front of his seat, barely able to make his right arm extend that far. His left arm hung uselessly at his side. When he had a firm grip on the handle, he closed his eyes and pulled firmly. First, the canopy blew off. Then Derek's seat soared upward, propelled by a magnetic rail. He only felt the initial kick before he became unconscious. The seat ejection mechanism, designed for Ruhar, had not been reset for a human on that flight, a flight in which the Dobra was not supposed to have a human crewman, a flight that was supposed to have been a quick and simple check ride. As Derek's seat blew upward into the airstream, the final crew escape mechanism activated. The straps that held Derek into the chair automatically released, and he was exposed to the 500-kilometer-per-hour airstream. Before his limbs could be torn off by the force of the air and deceleration, a flexible tube that he wore on his back came to life, and he was enveloped in an oval-shaped bubble. The computer built into the tube bent and compressed the bubble to keep him upright, and he flew through the air. Once the computer decided his speed had dropped below a preset mark, the bubble disappeared as suddenly as it formed. Without the unconscious Derek doing anything or knowing what was happening, the nanofabric of the bubble retracted inside the flexible tube, and the nanofabric changed its shape in a microsecond. The top of the tube came off, and the fabric was yanked upward. It was now a parachute, or technically a paraglider. The computer activated its sensors. If the computer had been capable of emotion, it would have been greatly dismayed. It was too low, and the ground beneath was thickly covered with trees in every direction. There were no safe places to glide to within the paraglider's range. With an electronic shrug, the computer decided that crashing into one treetop was as good as another, and it concentrated on slowing its passengers' rate of descent. The paraglider reformed its shape from a wedge to a half-sphere, and Derek was jolted again. Crashing down through the trees was no more gentle than what he had endured so far. With the parachute having lost lift, he fell straight down, bouncing off tree limbs and breaking branches. There was a final violent jolt as the parachute snagged on a tree limb, and he came to a stop 10 meters off the ground. The parachute computer, still active, calculated the distance, and the nanofabric of the parachute cords stretched to lower Derek almost gently to the ground. Satisfied that it had done all it could for the pilot, the parachute computer released the cords, and the pilot's bruised and battered body lay alone on the forest floor. Saley was not so lucky as Derek. The engine fan blade that struck the cockpit as they were separating penetrated the armor, and a piece punctured the seat, damaging its release mechanism. When Derek pulled the handle to eject them from the cockpit, Saley's seat should have ejected first. Because the cockpit computer knew her seat was damaged, it delayed Saley's ejection until after Derek was clear. But as the then-empty cockpit tumbled violently, components broke off in the airstream, and several pieces flew toward Saley. Right after she was released from the seat and the nanofabric began to blossom into a protective bubble around her, two sharp pieces of composite ripped through the still-forming bubble and into her. The ejection computer compensated as best it could, pulling the bubble tighter and attempting to seal the holes. It was partially successful, although the smaller bubble was not able to slow the pilot's uncontrolled rush through the air. Sensing the ground was coming up quickly, the computer judged that the least risky of several very bad options was to retract the bubble and reform the nanofabric as a parachute. At first, it was a small drogue parachute, used only to slow the pilot's speed through the air. When the computer decided it was safe, it spread the nanofabric out to its full extent. That was the only way to prevent the pilot from hitting the treetops at full speed. Unfortunately, the excessive speed and prior damage to the nanofabric meant the parachute immediately began to rip from the edge to the center. The computer attempted to compensate, and it was still working on knitting together the rip when Saley hit the treetops. The computer knew from talking with the medical status computer implanted in Saley that the pilot was seriously injured and bleeding, but the ejection computer could do nothing to assist the nano-based medical systems inside Saley's body. Saley crashed down through the trees, nearly breaking her back on a thick tree limb. She came to rest, tangled in branches and parachute cords, 12 meters off the ground. Acting on the medical computer's advice, the ejection computer decided not to try untangling the cords. It would be best, according to the medical computer, if the pilot did not move again while medical nanobots were working furiously to save her life. She hung upside down from a tree, unconscious, as machines too small to see tried their best to keep her life from slipping away. For Derek, coming back to consciousness was not a single event, but a lengthy process. He awakened 4 or 5 times before realizing that he was awake, that he was Derek, and that he hurt like hell all over. Then he remembered what had happened. Considering that he had been in a supersonic aircraft when it exploded around him, he decided that he shouldn't complain about some aches and pains, assuming that was all he had to worry about. Moving very slowly, he first tried to wiggle his toes, which was successful. Moving upward, he determined he was able to sit up. But when he tried to push himself up with his left hand, his shoulder flared in a white-hot shock of pain. Oh yeah, he thought. That arm had been out of position when the cockpit separated. If his arm was broken, that could be a big problem. He was able to stand, and painful testing by raising his left arm gave him confidence that nothing was broken. There might be a sprain or torn cartilage. Nothing the Ruhar couldn't fix if he could get to a hamster medical facility. And if they would consent to treat a human, and if they had equipment modified for human biology. Satisfied that he was mobile, he searched the pockets of his flight suit. He had a knife, a light, and a Z-phone. No sidearm, because humans were not allowed to have weapons. No food. Damn it. He was on a planet where he couldn't eat any of the native life or any of the crops the Ruhar grew on the continent of Tenturo, and his Z-phone wasn't working. It couldn't connect to the network. The network appeared to be down entirely. The Kristang could be jamming it, or they had knocked out the base infrastructure, or the Ruhar had simply cut off network access for humans once the fighting started, so he couldn't call for help. The map function did work. Where the hell was he? Not good. He was in the middle of nowhere. The closest Ruhar settlement was 4 or 5 days of hard walking at least. 4 days of walking through the wilderness, without food, to a Ruhar village that would not have any human food, and likely would not welcome a human wandering into their homes. They especially would not welcome a human while the Ruhar on Paradise were engaged in a war with the patrons of humanity.
Derek, he said to himself, you are totally screwed.
Before he started walking, he needed to see if he could find Saley. Her locator beacon would not be active until air search and rescue pinged it, so he couldn't use it to find her. Which direction to start? It didn't matter. The Ruhar pilot could be anywhere, although she should be within a kilometer or two. The paraglider should have steered her toward a safe landing zone, although according to the map, there weren't any. He would need to walk in one direction for a kilometer, then begin a grid search. He decided to begin by walking uphill. That way the return would be easier.
Chapter 20. Irene ran the sensor data back on the main display between the pilot and co-pilot seats and ran through it forward again quickly, with the 4 others looking over her shoulder. Thanks to Emby, they had a nearly complete view of the massive air battle that had now dissolved into desperate duels between individual aircraft.
Damn, Dave exhaled quietly.
This was the 3rd time they'd watched the replay. The 1st time everyone had been talking excitedly as they watched the symbols engage in a deadly dance across the screen. The 2nd time, Irene narrated the action from a pilot's viewpoint. The 3rd time they all simply sat and watched in shocked silence. Modern air combat was incredibly intense and high tempo. By MB's count, 88% of the combat aircraft on Paradise had been destroyed during the first 90 minutes of fighting. And the actual fighting had lasted perhaps 20 minutes, with the rest of the time taken by aircraft flying toward their targets, maneuvering into attack position, and flying back to their bases, if those bases still existed. Most aircraft had set down in remote areas relying on fuel, weapons, and spare parts being brought to them. Many of the surviving aircraft were crippled in one way or another. By the end of 2 hours, neither side had an effective air combat force left.
Now it's up to you guys. Irene looked at Dave and Jesse. What do you mean, ma'am?
Dave asked, confused. What did she expect him to do?
Not you two specifically. I meant infantry, Irene explained. Without enough air power to do anything useful, this becomes a ground war. Infantry. The Ruhar and the Kristang will have to rely on infantry.
To do? Jesse raced to guess what their pilot meant.
To do what?
How do you defeat an integrated air defense system? Perkins asked.
You make it unintegrated, Dave answered immediately.
This was easy training manual stuff.
Don't attack the whole system, that's suicide. You take it apart piece by piece.
Precisely, Perkins nodded.
Destroy one piece of the system at the edge. A radar, a launcher, one piece. That creates a gap in the integration, a blind spot, a weakness. Take out a few more pieces and you've created a safe passage corridor for your aircraft. Once you have that, you can send in a pure strike package instead of loading up the sorties with electronic countermeasure aircraft.
Until the enemy moves their pieces around, Irene added. Raiders and launchers are mobile.
They are, Perkins agreed. But these projectors are not mobile. The Kristang know that. They don't have sufficient air power left, so they will send in ground troops to destroy a projector or take it offline or take control of it. Once they know that particular projector is inactive, they know a part of the sky is not covered, and they can send in a ship. When enough projectors are confirmed offline, the Kristang can take back control of the sky.
Got it, Jesse said as the reality dawned on him. It's going to be a race between the hamsters and the lizards. The Ruhar will try to defend active projector sites and bring new ones online, and the Kristang will try to destroy them or take control.
The Ruhar should have an advantage, right? Shauna asked. Emby will tell them where the other projectors are, but the Kristang will have to guess.
I need to ask Emby what we do next, because this is a whole new ballgame, Perkins said, pulling out her Z-phone to type a new message.
As she typed, she looked at Jesse and Dave.
If we get involved in any ground action, I need you to, because I have no infantry experience. I handled intel for UNEF. Before that, I was in communications. I used a keyboard, not a rifle.
Ski was surprised.
Not even in basic training, ma'am?
She shook her head ruefully.
Not a whole lot. I was commissioned in the Air Force.
Air Force, ma'am?
Jesse asked with a quick glance at the U.S. Army insignia on her uniform. He was glad that he hadn't said anything bad about the other service in her presence. There was a blue-to-green initiative a while back, she explained. The U.S. military had needed more people in the Army and Marine Corps, more boots on the ground. Personnel in the Navy and Air Force were encouraged to transfer to green uniforms, strongly encouraged. They let me know that if I wanted to stay in as a career, I needed to switch services.
Oh. Jesse didn't know what else to say.
Glad to have you with us, ma'am. Dave also didn't know what else to say. MB's reply came swiftly. Proceed to the attached coordinates and activate the projector there as soon as possible. It was followed by a shorter message. Thank you. Good work.
Yes, Skippy exulted 2 days later. They did it. The fifth projector is now online. Joe, I will send a message of congratulations to Major Perkins and her team. Also, a message to get the hell out of there ASAP in case we need to use that projector real quick.
Agreed. Hey, Skippy, we can now shoot at Kristang's ships with this new projector?
That was the idea, Joe. Why?
Because now I'm thinking we don't do that. Not right away.
Once again, I'm not following your logic, Joe.
What I'm thinking is that when the Kristang jump a ship in to test us,
Joe,
I must caution you that the Kristang are likely to test our projectors with more than one ship. That is standard Kristang fleet doctrine when attacking a planet equipped with ground-based defenses.
That won't make any difference to what I want to do. In fact, that's even better. We let the Kristang get comfortable in orbit. They will at first stick to areas not covered by the four projectors they know about. When they think we only have those four projectors active, the first thing they will do is try hitting those projectors with a railgun strike, right?
That is sound tactics, yes. The projectors do have shields, although two of the projectors have very little power left for either shields or the maser.
Got it. Here's what we do, depending where the ships jump in.
Team, MB says we need to haul ass out of here pronto, Perkins declared. I think the Kristang are sure to come back to test whether we have more than those four projectors active. She didn't know two of those projectors were nearly depleted. If MB has to shoot soon, we don't want to be anywhere near this thing.
Do we have a new target, ma'am? Irene asked wearily. After parking her buzzard, she had helped the team set up the drill and punched down to the projector's control chamber. It had been Jesse's turn to go down the hole. The holes were now larger in diameter, but Irene still shook when she thought about it. Mercifully, Major Perkins had declared they could not risk their only pilot, so Irene was relieved of having to slide down into the ground again.
Yeah, of course, Perkins's voice reflected her own weariness. After the frantic scramble to get the first four projectors activated, they had all been dead tired. Then, MB had acted early for some reason and blasted the Kristang battle group from the sky. That had given the team a shot of energy they used to get the fifth projector dug out and online. Now, they were all running on empty.
Another projector. We'll need to go back to the truck to refuel first. Let's get moving, people.
Tired fingers fumbled and tired legs wobbled, but the task of breaking down the drill rig and tying it back in the sling was well known to them by now. By the time Irene came back with the buzzard and Shauna lowered the cable, the sling was ready. Major Perkins was swaying on her feet, fighting creeping sleepiness. They needed a break. According to MB, they couldn't afford to stop now. Regardless of MB's instructions, she was going to give the team 8 full hours of sleep after they got back to the truck and the buzzard was refueled. The pilot absolutely had to rest, and while Irene was sleeping, the rest of the team could get rest also. Paradise was going to have to get along without them for a few hours.
We didn't have to wait long for the Kristang to test whether the four projectors we'd used in our sneak attack were all we had.
They're here, Skippy announced.
A mere 2.5 hours after Perkins and the crew got the fifth projector working and cleared out of the area, 3 Kristang destroyers jumped in above the far side of the planet. Knowing the weak shields of their frigates did not stand a chance against our projectors, the Kristang had wisely left their little ships out of this action. The Kristang commander wasn't stupid. At first, he kept his ships out of the targeting cones of the 4 projectors that he knew about. When his ships were not hit, he must have figured we only had 4 projectors, which is exactly what I wanted the lizards to think. Next, he had to test the 4 known projectors to see if they were still active. After his surviving ships had jumped away, they must have examined all the sensor data from our sneak attack and realized that the last shots of 2 particular projectors were at a much lower power level. Logically, they correctly concluded that those projectors were almost drained of power, so they really only needed to worry about two of the known projectors.
They're lining up railgun shots on the projectors, Skippy warned. Even with five projectors, I can't hit those ships where they are now. They're going to fire railguns at an extremely shallow angle to keep the ships out of our targeting cones. That will decrease the impact of the railgun darts because they will be traveling through more of the atmosphere.
Do you think, Skippy?
Two of the destroyers fired their railguns at our two healthy projectors. They knew those two projectors couldn't hit the ships from where they were, and they also knew the other two projectors didn't have enough power to penetrate a destroyer's shields. What they didn't know about was the incredible awesomeness of Skippy the Magnificent. As the railgun darts streaked in at 22% of light speed, they passed through the targeting cone of a mostly depleted projector. That projector couldn't harm a shielded starship, but its maser did have enough power to deflect the darts from their targets and break the darts into bite-sized pieces. By itself, a projector couldn't have hit a speeding dart, but our projectors were controlled by Skippy, so hitting two objects traveling at almost a quarter of light speed was not a problem. He simply fired the maser ahead of the ballistic flight path of a dart and let the dart fly into it.
Oh my God, those freaking darts were slow as molasses in January, Skippy complained, using an expression I hadn't heard since my grandmother said it.
Did the Kristang actually use a railgun, or did they just toss those darts out a window? I got so bored waiting for them that I did 100 crossword puzzles. Anyway, it worked.
The dart pieces impacted the surface around the projectors and threw up two enormous clouds of dust and debris, but only one piece the size of a fingernail did hit a projector. That piece was easily deflected by the projector's shield, leaving the maser cannon unharmed. And the Kristang, whose crappy senses entirely missed our maser firing, saw two plumes of dust surrounding the two healthy projectors and concluded their strike had been successful. They congratulated themselves on knocking out two multi-terawatt projectors, bragging on ship-to-ship transmissions about how badass they were. Skippy almost puked listening to them.
Oh yeah, you're badasses, all right. Give me a minute and we'll salute you great warriors properly.
Skippy's idea of a salute came in the form of maser beams. With the Kristang semi-confident there were no active projectors on the surface, they sent one, then all three destroyers into the targeting cones. Each destroyer, brave but not stupid, would only briefly flit through the targeting cone. That was all Skippy needed. As soon as there were two destroyers within range at the same time, he told me to press the big red button on my Z-phone to fire the weapons. Two destroyers against three projectors. Two of those projectors had only one shot each left, and the shields of a Kristang destroyer could deflect the full power of a projector long enough for the ship to perform an emergency jump away. The odds were not in our favor. Skippy, of course, didn't see any point in playing fair. Both of the projectors the Kristang thought they had knocked out fired 2 milliseconds apart. Each of those projectors fired at a different ship, and by themselves they could not have penetrated a destroyer's shields. A secret fifth projector also fired, first at one ship and then at the second, each shot 2 milliseconds apart, so that each ship was struck by the full power of two projectors at once. The combined maser power punched right through the destroyer's shields. The ship's hulls were armored, made of layers of tough ceramic composites and heat-dissipating foam. If the maser beams had a sense of humor, they would have laughed at the Kristang ship designers' attempt to protect their vessels. The maser beams cut through the hulls as if they were tissue paper, slicing the ships apart. Thick, armored interior bulkheads melted under the intense heat, exploding and becoming projectiles inside their own ships. Power conduits ruptured, and missiles spontaneously exploded in their launch tubes, turning the ships into spinning hulks. The lucky third destroyer immediately jumped away.
"Hey, where did you go, asswipe?" Skippy shouted.
"You want some of this? You want some of this?
Say hello to my little friend, Mr. Maser Beam."
"I got plenty more where that came from, you punk-ass bitch."
"Damn, Skippy, chill out. You got them already," I said, as on the display, one of the stricken destroyers blew apart when its missile magazine cooked off.
"I do not like lizards, Joe. I do not like bullies. Big red button again, Joe."
"Sure," I said, as I held the button down.
"Why?"
"One of those ships is annoyingly lucky. It hasn't blown up yet. One of our original four projectors only has a weak shot left, but what happens when even a weak maser hits an unshielded ship's reactor?"
On the display I was watching, a light flared where a crippled destroyer had been.
"Oops," Skippy chuckled. "My bad. Sorry about that."
"Darn, I hate it when that happens.
Well, I'm sure the Kristang will forgive and forget. Or not. Whatever.
I'm thinking not, Skippy. Hey, that was great. I accepted a high five from Sergeant Adams. Keep monitoring their communications, please. I want to know if the Kristang plan to test our defenses again.
Unlikely, Joe. The Kristang commander is right now screaming at his remaining ships to stay away from the planet until his ground forces can degrade our air defense capability. There was supposed to be a follow-on attack by the other Kristang ships, but that has now been postponed indefinitely.
Huh. I wonder why, I asked with a smile. Maybe they didn't sell enough tickets, Joe?
How much longer should we wait, Commodore?
Commodore Ferlant answered his executive officer's question without turning his attention away from the tactical display. If Ferlant were an admiral, the Rue Gustalo would have a captain, and Ferlant would have to concern himself only with commanding his task force. Because he was not an admiral, he needed to also act as the ship's captain. Because he didn't have time to act as captain in the middle of a running battle, most of the responsibility for ship handling fell to his executive officer, Tom Smith.
We will wait until the Dulandu has a full charge, Ferlant announced.
The frigate Sos Dulandu had accompanied Ferlant's cruiser on every jump after the projectors had thrown the situation around Gitanu into absolute chaos. Since Ferlant's initial order for his small task force to scatter, his ships had been hounded by the still much larger force of remaining Kristang ships. Every time one of his ships jumped, the enemy attempted to pursue, analyzing the residual signature of the Ruhar ship's outbound wormholes to determine where they had jumped to. Each time one of his ships jumped, they dropped off quantum resonators behind them to confuse enemy sensors and conceal the jump wormhole signature. The resonators were partially effective, as it usually took the Kristang almost an hour to determine where the Ruhar had gone. But after 39 hours of unrelenting pursuit, Ferlant's ships were running low on quantum resonators, and his ship's jump drives were badly in need of a rest to recalibrate their coils. They would likely get no such rest. Each time the Ruhar ships jumped with misaligned coils, their messy jump created a louder signature, and the quantum resonators became less and less effective at concealing where the ship had jumped to. Eventually, Ferlant knew the Kristang would wear his ships down. The Kristang had several significant advantages in the pursuit. They still had more ships, so they could send several ships on pursuit while the others stood down for maintenance, and they could concentrate on killing Ferlant's ships one at a time, while merely keeping his other ships moving so they couldn't effectively support each other.
Commodore, Smith said quietly, this can't continue forever.
They were waiting for the Sos Dulandu to complete charging her jump coils, because that frigate's coils were overheating due to overuse. Soon, individual coils would begin to burn out, throwing that ship's entire jump drive system so badly out of alignment that it would be unable to sustain a jump wormhole.
I know, Ferlant answered quietly.
So far, he had not lost a single ship, although the destroyer City of Falenton had been badly damaged in an attack. The Lenten was able to jump, but not able to do much else. Her stealth field and defensive shields were inoperable. Ferlant had assigned the City of McMurrow to accompany her stricken sister ship, but the Lenten might need to be abandoned, and her crew transferred to the McMurrow. He was losing the fight. It had become a battle of attrition, and his ships were wearing out faster than the Kristang ships were falling apart.
When the Dulandu is ready, we are jumping outside the system. Three jumps, maximum range.
We're abandoning Gitanu? Smith asked.
He agreed with the Commodore's decision. He also wanted to understand it.
We are effecting a temporary strategic retreat in order to regroup and regain the initiative, Ferlant explained in proper military terms.
Someday, high-ranking fleet officials would review the bridge data recorder during the action to determine whether Commodore Ferlant's decisions had been appropriate. Hopefully, Ferlant would be alive then to explain himself.
Our ships need an opportunity to go offline and effect repairs.
Smith agreed.
If the Kristang will leave us alone long enough.
I am cautiously optimistic that once he knows we have left the system, Admiral Kekrondo will turn his attention back to reestablishing his control of the space around Gitanu.
And after our repairs are complete? Smith asked.
Then we regain the initiative, Ferlant said with a tight smile.
Sir?
The hunters will become the hunted.
I can walk, Celie assured Derek. Her legs were not as assuring. She could not, in fact, walk.
It doesn't look like it, Derek said gently. My right leg is fine, she insisted.
Her left leg was broken in two places, somewhere along her way crashing down through the trees. She also had internal injuries from whatever piece of the exploding Dobra had hit her after they ejected. When Derek found Saley, she had been unconscious, tangled in parachute cords, hanging upside down. Working carefully with his injured shoulder, Derek had cut away cords and parachute fabric to make a rope and slowly lowered her to the ground. Peeling away her blood-soaked flight suit, he found an ugly, bloody wound on her left side. Whatever magical nanobots swam in her blood had done their best to stitch the wound closed, but she had already lost a lot of blood, based on the amount that had soaked her flight suit and dripped onto the forest floor. In her flight kit, Derek had found bandages, emergency rations, and 4 vials of injectable medical supplements. He couldn't read all of the complicated Ruhar technical terms, so he used his Z-phone's camera to translate for him. The vials contained additional nanobots, vitamins and minerals, and whatever types of sugars and proteins the Ruhar used as food.
Do we have a choice?
No, Derek agreed. While his Z-phone wasn't working, Saley had been able to exchange brief, encrypted messages with the Ruhar military guard system. She had sent a distress call, stating her injuries, location, and that she was with a human co-pilot. She urgently needed medical care. Derek was also injured, and Derek did not have any source of food. The reply was not encouraging. Air rescue was out of the question. The horrific air battle had wiped out most of the Ruhar's combat aircraft. The few aircraft that remained were being reserved to defend vital infrastructure or to conduct strikes against the Kristang. Risking a precious aircraft with 5 crew members to rescue 1 downed pilot was not an option at that time. Saley was advised to walk her way out. There was a road several days away. If she could get near the road, Ruhar Command would see if any of the civilians in the area would be willing to drive out to pick her up. Basically, the reply stated that there was a war on and they didn't have any aircraft to spare. The reply also wished her good luck. Ruhar Command didn't say anything about Derek, other than to question why a human had been with Saley in the first place. They had no suggestion what he should do about the lack of food.
If you can stand, you can lean on my shoulder, Derek suggested. Let's try that.
Holding onto a tree, Saley managed to stand on 1 wobbly leg. Derek got her arm draped over his shoulder and they practiced stumbling through the forest.
Easy enough, Derek concluded. This is like a 3-legged race.
What? Saley asked, confused. Derek shook his head. That reference hadn't translated into Ruhar as he intended.
It's a human custom, something we do at picnics. Forget it, let's save our energy.
With his free hand, he checked the map on his Z-phone. Getting to the road was not going to be easy. There were hills to climb and streams to cross. As they walked, Saley would grow weaker from her unhealed injuries, and Derek would grow weaker from hunger.
One step at a time. Here we go.
Admiral, the Vikran reports that the entire enemy force has jumped outside the system, the captain of the Kedwala stated.
The destroyer, we are proud to honor Clan Subleader Belden Ush Vikran, who inspires us every day, was a brothership of the We Are Proud to Follow the Shining Example of Combat Rifleman Tutwas Val Kedwala. But while the Kedwala had the dubious honor of hosting the Admiral, the Vikran had been off having fun and seeking glory chasing the Ruhar Task Force. With the Admiral's normal command ship, the battlecruiser He Who Pushes Aside Fear Shall Always Be Victorious having been obliterated by a projector above Pardassus, the Kedwala had become the battlegroup's command ship by default. Neither the Admiral nor the crew of the Kedwala were happy about the situation, but whereas Admiral Kikrondo was free to express his dissatisfaction loudly and frequently, the crew of the Kedwala had to at least pretend they were honored to host the battlegroup commander. Because to openly state their fervent desire to stuff the Admiral and his staff into an airlock and blow them into space would not be a good career move. Although that was a totally understandable sentiment.
Confirmed. The enemy has now performed 3 consecutive jumps beyond the system limits and might be preparing to jump again. The Vikran requests instructions.
Technically, the captain of the Vikran himself was not requesting instructions. The Vikran had been sent back to the Kedwala by Senior Captain Gurkaw in command of the pursuit squadron. That senior captain had requested instructions, and he had not so much requested instructions as hoped that the standing instructions he already had would be changed. Admiral Cicrondo had ordered the pursuit squadron to halt pursuit if the enemy passed a certain distance from the Pardassus system, and the pursuit squadron had already gone beyond that imaginary line. The senior captain hoped the admiral would ignore that minor violation and give permission to continue the pursuit. The enemy's ships were worn down, the senior captain's message said excitedly. Another couple jumps, surely a dozen at most, and the pursuit squadron would have the Ruhar trapped. Cicrondo read the message with displeasure. Most of his demanding job, he thought angrily, was reining in overly aggressive commanders who were eager to do stupid, rash things that risked losing the considerable advantage his battlegroup still possessed. The fact that frequent use of overly aggressive, rash actions were how he had become promoted to the Admiralty did not cross Cicrondo's mind. The battlegroup was his command now, and if anyone was going to do something recklessly stupid, it was going to happen on Cicrondo's orders, not on the initiative of glory and promotion-seeking Senior Captain Gurkaw. With Admiral Cicrondo having lost most of his combat power to a sneak attack by previously unknown projectors, he knew his position in command was precarious. If the clan leadership was looking to replace Cicrondo, a senior captain in command of a successful pursuit squadron would be a convenient candidate.
"Inform Senior Captain Gurkaw that he is to adhere to my standing instructions," Cicrondo said firmly. "He is not to run off and risk my ships in his personal desire for glory."
19 hours had passed, and there was no sign of continued pursuit by the Cristang. Cautiously, Commodore Ferlant allowed two ships at a time to take critical systems offline for much-needed maintenance. His cruiser Rue Gustalo would remain on full alert to protect the vulnerable ships undergoing repairs. Only after all the other ships in the little task force had been brought to full combat readiness would the Gustalo herself begin heavy maintenance. As Ferlant had risen through the ranks to captain and now temporary commodore, he had come to rely more and more on a quote from one of his instructors way back at the military academy. She had told the class that amateurs discuss tactics, professionals discuss logistics. Ferlant had not been surprised to learn that even the humans had a similar saying on their primitive home world. Tactics, Ferlant considered as he reviewed ship status reports, were useless without the means to implement them. The ships under his command were warships only if they were capable of performing near their designed capability, and to accomplish that required constant attention to tasks that were painstaking and mundane. Combat action, even an action of continually running from enemy pursuit, wore down critical systems. Without a pause to rest, repair, and replace vital components, his warships would become nothing more than composite tubes which held air only so long as the enemy held off attack. Despite constant demands from the government on Gitanu for his ships to come back, Ferlant was not going to be hasty and stupid. He was going to take a pause from the battle in order to bring all of his ships back up to full fighting condition. All of his ships, that is, except for the destroyer City of Falenton. That ship had been badly damaged in a Cristang attack. It had barely escaped from a damping field while providing cover to give the frigate Sastalandu time to jump away. A destroyer risking itself to protect a much less valuable frigate was a questionable tactic, but Ferlant had not criticized the Lenten's captain. Ferlant would have done the same thing had he been in command of the destroyer. The Lenten was too heavily damaged to be brought back up to full combat capability, so Ferlant instructed that ship's crew to perform only cosmetic repairs and basic maintenance on the jump drive and defensive shields. Ferlant had a special task in mind for the Lenten. One last task. Eric Koblenz had gone from elation to severe depression to cautious hopefulness to confused disappointment in the space of a week, and now he was merely numb. When the Cristang battlegroup arrived in orbit and chased the Ruhar ships away, the Keeper faction and UNEF had been triumphant, certain that life for UNEF would now return to normal, that those humans who had been disloyal to the Cristang would be punished, and that loyal Keepers would soon return to Earth, having accomplished their mission for the Cristang. Eric experienced a joyous few days, warning disloyal non-Keepers that their fate was sealed, certain that his loyalty would be rewarded. Keeper leaders attempted to contact the Cristang in the days immediately following arrival of the battlegroup, but they were rebuffed. Then came a scathing message from the Cristang that was a stinging rebuke. All humans had in some way cooperated with the Ruhar, if only by growing their own food, and therefore removing a logistics burden from the enemy Ruhar. Those who called themselves keepers were equally traitorous. The Kristang valued action, not words, and the keepers had not done anything against the Ruhar. Also, the Kristang no longer had access to Earth, so no humans would be going home. The Kristang were not impressed by the actions of some keepers to destroy tractors and other equipment the Ruhar provided, equipment the Ruhar had already remotely disabled. Eric didn't know what to do or think. What was the point of remaining loyal to an alien species that considered him to be a traitor? His government on Earth had allied with the Kristang. Now that government on humanity's homeworld had no effective authority over the people isolated on an alien world. He had no good options. No hope.
Major Perkins, ma'am, Irene called her current commanding officer into the buzzard's cockpit. I just picked up a distress call about the downed Ruhar pilot. She's injured and not far from here.
Perkins frowned. As a pilot, Strebitch might feel a call to rescue any and all of her fellow aviators in distress. Perkins couldn't allow her team to be distracted from their mission.
I'm sure there are many pilots down after that air battle. Yes, ma'am, but this Ruhar pilot has a human with her.
What?
How did that happen?
How, I don't know, ma'am, Irene admitted.
The distress call is from the human, a Lieutenant Derek Bonsu. He was the co-pilot or weapons system officer in a chicken when the battle started.
I guess they got caught up in the furball. He tried to get air rescue from the Ruhar, but they have few aircraft left, and they are unable to assist at this time.
They've been down since the day of the air battle?
Yes, ma'am. The Ruhar is in a bad way. She's injured and still losing blood. This Lieutenant Bonsu doesn't have any food.
Irene pointed at the map on the display.
Even by himself, it would take him a couple more days to walk to the nearest Ruhar settlement, and they wouldn't have any human food there. He says his pilot won't last that long anyway.
This area, her finger circled the map, is remote. No roads and few settlements. They need air rescue.
Shit. Damn it.
It can be done, ma'am, Irene assured Perkins. We can lure a crewman to hook them up to a cable.
Lieutenant, I meant damn it as in of course we do have to assist. We are not leaving a human out there to starve.
Irene couldn't keep a smile off her face.
It will only be a 40-minute flight, ma'am, going low and slow.
Don't start the engines yet, Strebic. First, I'm going to contact MB and see if they can do anything to help them without us.
If not, ma'am, then I'm going to ask MB what the mission security fallout will be of us bringing a Ruhar aboard.
And we'll need to fly this Ruhar someplace where she can get medical care. That will seriously blow our cover.
We could retrieve only Lieutenant Bonsu, Irene said with a frown.
Major Perkins snorted.
Strebic, you're a pilot. Would you leave one of your aircrew behind?
No, she answered without hesitation.
I expect this Lieutenant Bonsu feels the same way about his pilot.
She sighed and pulled out her Z-phone to type a message.
At times like this, I wish MB would answer a simple damned phone call instead of me typing everything.
Crap, Skippy, I said when we got the message from Perkins. Does Perkins have to pick this guy up? That road isn't far. At least it didn't appear very far on the map. I wasn't on the ground walking on an empty stomach.
If I can get there, he can follow the road to this village here. I pointed to a dot on the map.
That expression never made any sense to me, Joe. How do you follow a road? Roads are static. They never move. If you said, follow a car on the road, then I would understand. Maybe the expression should be, remain on the road. Although if you say road, it is kind of implied that you stay on it, unless the instructions...
Skippy.
What?
Focus. Please try to focus.
Forget what I said. If this guy thinks he can't make it to the road, I'm not going to sit here and second-guess him. Especially since I could smell the lasagna that Adams was heating up for dinner, and Bonsu hadn't eaten for days. A downed human pilot. I should have thought of this.
There are an infinite number of things you should have thought of and didn't, Joe, Skippy replied.
Like, you have bread and peanut butter, but no fluff. Therefore, no fluffernutter for you.
This is a little more important, Skippy. Although after he said it, I was craving the sweet and salty deliciousness of a fluffernutter.
I'll need to call Chotek about this. Is there anything you can do to help those pilots, instead of Perkins rescuing them?
Not that I can see, Joe. The air assets of both the Ruhar and Kristang are severely depleted, and Lieutenant Bonsu is in sort of a no-man's land between the two forces.
Ah, boy. This isn't going to be good.
We need to plan for Perkins's cover to be blown for the remainder of her mission.
Why, Joe? We could just order her to continue the mission and forget Lieutenant Bonsu.
Skippy, I said wryly, I don't want to become a Dan Pogue. You forget that before I got this cushy day job, I was a soldier in the field. Perkins asking permission to rescue those two pilots was more of an FYI. She's going, unless we have a better idea.
Oh, okay, Joe. I couldn't imagine you leaving Bonsu out there to starve anyway.
You got that right. I picked up my Z-phone to call the Flying Dutchman. What the hell was I going to say to Chotek?
Hey, Skippy. Perkins blowing her cover doesn't involve any risk of our cover being blown, does it?
The shiny little beer can chuckled.
No way, dude. I've got our tracks totally covered. Do what you gotta do. I've got your back.
I appreciate that, Skippy.
Flying Dutchman? This is Colonel Joe Bishop. I need to speak with Mr. Chotek, please.
Chapter 21.
Chotek did not entirely agree with my opinion that Perkins rescuing the two pilots posed zero risk of exposing our involvement. It took a lot of convincing, and in the end, Lieutenant Colonel Chang had the deciding vote. The fact is, Chotek trusted the calm, steady experience of Chang to me. When Chang told our UN mission commander that the operation posed no additional risk, Chotek very reluctantly agreed. I think Chotek appreciated me requesting permission from him, rather than making a snap decision on my own. That helped our relationship later when I really needed him to cut me some slack and trust me.
Okay, we have the green light from the mission commander. We need to send a message to Perkins, telling her to pick up Lieutenant Bonsu.
Sir, Adams interjected, we can't send a message about picking up a human. Envy is supposed to be a native Ruhar group. They would care about the injured Ruhar pilot, not about a human.
Oh, I mentally chided myself for being a dumbass.
That is an excellent point, Sergeant.
Do that, Skippy.
Done. Message sent, Colonel, Skippy announced cheerily. While we're waiting for a reply from Major Perkins, I have a question for you, Joe.
If it's about calculus or poetry, it is unlikely I have an answer.
I will take a risk on that, Skippy chuckled.
You said that you don't want to be a pogue. I'm not sure that I understand that reference.
A pogue is a soldier who serves in a support unit, not in combat. Supposedly it stands for persons other than grunts, but I think that was made up later.
Ah, I thought that was a fobbit, Joe.
Fobbit is a newer term, from when the army started setting up forward operating bases. Before that was Remph, for rear echelon motherfucker. Those are the assholes who sleep in a real bed every night, while infantry grunts are lucky to find rock to sleep on.
Okay, Remph and Pogue. I will add those to my list of colorful expressions. Joe, I have noticed that your language has become less, I guess the best word would be, salty since we met.
Yes, Skippy. I tapped the silver eagles on my uniform. The army expects me to be an officer and a gentleman now. I can't be dropping F-bombs all over the place. Although I knew some colonels who used very salty language.
You. A gentleman. So that means you clean up your language? What's next? Will you be serving afternoon tea? Those little sandwiches with the crusts cut off? Ooh, and ballroom dancing lessons for you.
Skippy?
Yes?
I dropped a whole string of F-bombs until Adams burst out laughing. Skippy chuckled also.
There's the Joe I know.
Derek stumbled on a rock and fell to one knee. He leaned forward as he fell so he wouldn't fall backward and injure Saley. The pilot behind him groaned.
Saley, he asked, are you awake?
She didn't respond.
He looked at the terrain in front of them. It was a meadow with clusters of trees dotted here and there. In a meadow, he didn't have to constantly duck to avoid Saley's head being hit by low-hanging tree branches. But while a forest had some undergrowth, a meadow was all undergrowth. Tall grasses, vines, and shrubs could tangle his feet and hide holes he couldn't see. The worst part of crossing the meadow was that it sloped up, and there was no way around climbing something. He needed to go northwest, and the map showed the meadow had the gentlest slope in the area. That was why he was stumbling across it. Saley groaned again. Exhausted and lightheaded from deep hunger, Derek let his other knee down and unbuckled the strap that held the pilot to his back. Saley had fallen the day before and been unable to rise. Then she'd become unconscious. The nanoparticles in her blood were conserving her remaining blood supply by making her sleep. While she was asleep, she wasn't moving and causing additional stress on the injuries the nanoparticles had hastily stitched together. When she had been awake, Saley had warned him that she might fall into sort of a coma if the nanobots in her blood decided that was the only way to extend her life. Ruhar Biology had a way to go into a type of hibernation during times of extreme stress and deprivation. In the deep, coma-like hibernation, Ruhar bodies used very little oxygen, water, and stored fuel. They could also withstand cold temperatures for lengthy periods. It wasn't a pleasant experience, she explained, but she'd undergone a practice hibernation during boot camp military training. The hibernation ability wasn't an original feature of Ruhar Biology. That had been added long ago using genetic engineering. That same tweaking of Ruhar DNA was the reason she was still alive. She had superior healing abilities. Enhanced genetics and nanobots were, Derek thought, very good things to have. Right then, his growling stomach would have settled for a sandwich. The previous night, Derek had injected her with the last vial of energy juice, so she was now running out of sugar or whatever Ruhar biochemistry used for fuel. He unbuckled the lower strap and let the Ruhar pilot slump gently backwards until she lay on the grass. Touching her neck, he was surprised to find her pulse strong and fast, until he realized that what he was feeling was his own pulse pounding in his fingertip from exertion. I need to rest, he said to no one but himself. 2 hours later, by the clock on his Z-phone, he woke up when the clouds parted and a shaft of sunlight illuminated the meadow. Panicked, he rolled to his knees and checked on Saley. She was as he had left her, breathing very slowly, her pulse slow and weak, non-responsive. Shaking his canteen told him it was almost full, so he parted her lips with his fingers and very slowly dribbled half of the water into her mouth, letting her automatically swallow. Then he greedily drank the other half of the water. The map said there was a stream cutting across the meadow near the top, where the meadow ended and the woods resumed. He could refill the canteen there. One advantage of being in an alien biosphere was that none of the microorganisms in the water could harm him or Saley. With a start, he woke again 20 minutes later. Hunger pangs were what caused him to waken. They weren't going to get any better. Time to make a decision, Bonsu, he said to himself. He couldn't go much further carrying Saley. He could barely stand on his own. 10 meters away was a grove of trees centered on one large tree. That was a good place. He staggered to his knees, then one on one foot, then the other. Holding the Ruhar under her arms, he slowly dragged her backwards until she rested against the large trees, looking toward the east. Then, carefully, so he didn't fall as spots formed in his vision, he sat down beside her. Nice spot, isn't it? He asked Saley. Great view. Looking eastward, he imagined he could see where they had come from. There was the hill they had skirted to the north. And was that the lake they had walked around? It was in the marshy area, just beyond the lake, that Saley had fallen. That time she had been able to walk again after a short rest, but half an hour later she had slumped unconscious, and Derek had rigged up straps to carry her on his back. They weren't going to make it to safety. He'd known that since the message came back that the Ruhar had no assets to spare for an air rescue, and they were too far in the wilderness for anyone to hike in to get them in time. From twisting contrails he'd seen high in the sky since they were shot down, the air battle was still ongoing, although mostly he'd seen only one or two contrails at a time. Both sides must be running low on combat aircraft. Since the Ruhar replied that no rescue would be coming anytime soon, Derek's plan had changed from walking to a settlement, where Saley could get medical care, to walking toward a settlement. At that point, it was about not giving up, about making progress. It was about showing the Ruhar that humans were reliable partners, and mostly, it was about doing something other than laying down and starving to death. Or, it had been about that, back when he had not been so weak that he no longer had a choice. He was awakened by an annoying buzzing sound. Automatically, he slapped at the air until he remembered there were no flying insects on Paradise. Native life on the planet had not evolved that far yet. What was that sound? Now that he noticed, it was bothering him because it was right at the edge of his hearing. What the hell was it? Paradise had insects that chirped or buzzed. He was familiar with most of those. No, it couldn't be insects buzzing in the meadow, because the sound came from one direction rather than all around him. What was even more odd was the sound was moving north to south and growing louder. With a sudden shock, he recognized the sound. It was aircraft jet engines in stealth mode. The Kristang. The Ruhar had no aircraft to spare for a rescue, but the Kristang must have sent one of their aircraft. Were they picking up the signal from Saley's emergency locator beacon? She said she had deactivated it. Maybe the Kristang picked up the beacon back then and were now searching for downed Ruhar aircrew. Derek tried to stand up, but he couldn't. He got to his knees, regretting they had discarded Saley's sidearm along the way. The weapon would not have activated for Derek anyway. It still would have felt better to have it in his hand and pointed toward the Kristang, or to shoot Saley than himself. He knew he did not want to be captured, and he was sure Saley felt the same way. Now, damn it, he didn't have a choice. The sound grew much louder now, and a faint shadow fell across him. The aircraft was between him and the sun, and it must have its stealth field engaged. It sounded very much like a buzzard. He had never heard the Kristang ship that was their equivalent of a buzzard. Probably it was similar. The faint shadow moved out over the meadow. Then he could see the vague blob that was an aircraft in stealth. The air around the stealth field shimmered. In an atmosphere, stealth fields were only useful as long ranges. "Oh my God," he gasped when the aircraft dropped its stealth field as it approached the meadow for landing. It was a buzzard. He recognized not only the shape but the insignia. It was from the 18th Air Squadron. He knew some of those Ruhar. The 18th had flown into his airbase for joint exercises. Derek found the strength to hold on to the tree and rise unsteadily to his feet. He waved to the buzzard with one arm, holding the tree with the other. The Ruhar were not there for him. They had come for Saley. If they took her, that did not guarantee they would take a human with them. Derek knew many Ruhar still hated humans, especially Ruhar who were native to Gitanu. If the crew of that buzzard were going to leave him behind to starve, they were going to have to look him in the eye before they took off. Mentally prepared for Ruhar soldiers to shove him aside and take only Saley, he was shocked when the buzzard's side door opened and two humans stepped out. "Lieutenant Bonsu," the woman said. "I'm Major Perkins. This is Specialist Coulter." Derek kept enough of his wits to point toward his feet. "I have an uninjured Ruhar pilot with me. Please help her." "We will," Perkins said. "And you need food. We have it."
"Success, Joe," Skippy said excitedly. "Major Perkins picked up Lieutenant Derek Bonsu and the Ruhar pilot. Bonsu will be fine after he gets some food. He also has a shoulder injury that should be looked at if he is going to regain full function. The Ruhar pilot is in self-induced hibernation. Specialist Jarrett has administered a stabilizing drug that was in the buzzard's medical kit. The pilot needs medical care. Expert Ruhar medical care. Soon." "Maybe when this is over," I mused, "this Derek guy will get taken care of by the Ruhar."
"Derek," Adams said thoughtfully. "I dated a Derek in high school."
I thought she was going to say more about her dating experience, but Skippy interrupted.
"That's a coincidence, Sarge Marge. Joe dated a Margaret in high school."
"Everyone called her Meg," I started to explain.
"It didn't end well," Skippy said, sounding amused already. "Her father got upset because Joe peed her name in the snow outside her house, if you know what I mean."
"Skippy, it didn't exactly happen like..."
"What really got her father upset was that he recognized it was written in his daughter's handwriting."
"Oh boy," I groaned. "You know, people used to get a pass on doing things when you're young and stupid, and after a while everyone forgot about it."
"That was before everything lived forever on Facebook, Joe."
I sighed, knowing he was right.
"Any chance you can erase all that embarrassing stuff when we get back to Earth, Skippy?"
"Oh," Skippy snorted.
"Easy peasy, Joe."
"Great," I brightened with hope.
"Thank you.
But what's the fun in that?" Skippy asked. "It would be way more fun if someone took all the embarrassing stuff that people have forgotten about and added it to your profile, which might have happened shortly before we left Earth."
"Might have?"
"I'm speculating here, Joe. Someone might have done that, plus added really embarrassing stuff about you from your sister's diary, like your bedwetting, and the time she caught you playing with yourself. Times, I should say. Was it 2 or 3 times? I mean, who gets excited looking at the women on the cover of your mother's romance novels?"
Desai exploded with laughter, and Adams couldn't help joining her.
"I'm sorry, sir,"
Desai managed to say while avoiding looking at me. Adams, I groaned, with my forehead gently banging against the table. Do you have a sidearm?
Yes, Colonel, she managed to say while laughing. You want me to shoot Skippy?
I don't think anything short of a planet-cracking nuke would hurt him, I muttered. Could you put your sidearm against my head and pull the trigger a couple times? Put me out of my misery?
I think that would be against some sort of regulation, sir, she apologized.
It's a mercy killing, I pleaded. There's no way I can go back to Earth now.
Why, Joe? Skippy asked.
Is it because of the outstanding warrants? Don't worry. The statute of limitations on indecent exposure is only like 5 years, I think.
Not helping, Skippy?
You are not helping one bit.
Joe, making you face your shortcomings is helping you in the long run, Skippy protested.
Also, a lot of fun for me, although of course that was not my motivation. That you know of.
The next time a beer can on a dusty shelf starts talking to me, I am going to walk out and lock the door behind me.
Whoa, slow down there, partner, Jesse cautioned as Derek greedily gulped a container of nutrient mush and reached for another. Your stomach is shrunk. You need to go slow.
Is that, Derek mumbled through a mouthful of mush, chocolate chip cookies?
He pointed to a box in Jesse's lap.
Yes.
Jesse lifted the box out of the pilot's reach.
Damn, he thought. This is like dealing with a child. Well, the man had to be damned hungry by now.
They are real honest-to-God chocolate chip cookies from... He was about to say America, but the box said Belgium.
Earth. You eat two of those mushes and let your stomach get used to it. Then you can have a cookie.